Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Hello, 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 my wonderful audience, cutting edge pioneers in multiple fields, medicine, psychiatry, the law, psychology, social work, epidemiology, folks doing the most thoughtful analyses, come on the show, listen to the show, all around the world, with especially good connections in Canada and, of course, Great Britain. Today, we're staying home with a wonderful guest, Brant Mittler. Let me check and see if he's there before I fill you in on the latest news with me. Brant, are you there?
Yes, Peter.
Oh, you sound really, really good. Brant was last on the show January 7th, 2015. He's going to be extremely interesting. First, though, I want to catch you up on my completion of one of the most difficult projects I've ever done, and that is the blog series of 6 reports that's now up on my website and is being hosted formally on MIA, Mad in America. Thanks very much to Bob Whitaker and to Emmeline, who does wonderful, wonderful work with me, who takes care of the blog section. I don't know that I've ever been so invested in writing something since I wrote Toxic Psychiatry in the early 90s. I spent on the case itself hundreds of hours, I now have spent, I don't know, just a ton more trying to compensate and overcome the injustice of the case. You know, Michelle Carter was portrayed as the nastiest girl on earth who told her boyfriend to back into his fume-filled truck to die. Well, actually, both she and Conrad Roy were victims of things far beyond their control. Michelle, one of the sweetest human beings I've ever heard about or met, got put on psychiatric drugs, antidepressants, at the age of 14. Then at the age of 15, got involved with Conrad Roy. And as she turned 16, found out that he wasn't who he seemed to be, as he said to her. He was very depressed, very angry, very upset young man, going through his parents' divorce at the time, who had serious suicide attempts. And for the next 2 years, he would be driven to kill himself again. And he got Michelle into telling him again and again, don't do it. And he kept scaring her and upsetting her and telling her, I'm going to kill myself tonight and there's nothing you can do about it. All this documented in my 6 blogs. And finally, Michelle flipped out toward the end and decided the only way she could help him was by going to heaven. She had recently been started on a new antidepressant. She gets into a delusional state where she thinks she can help him go to heaven, and then she can represent him on earth, and they'll communicate between heaven and earth. It's all in there texting, and that she'll even help his parents get over his loss, but he'll at last be happy. It's 10 days that she flips out, and she doesn't, I'm not going to tell you all this story, because it's just an incredible story, and she gets convicted for telling him to go back in the truck, but as you'll see, there's no evidence she ever even said the words, let alone if she did, should it have caused her to be hounded by the Bristol County DA's office. And you're going to find out why they hounded her. I can't believe the information I got of political and personal ambitions, of vendettas, literal vendettas by the actual definition of the word, a blood feud by the wounded family of Conrad Roy. Wait till you see some of the stuff. I'll give you a hint. The chief prosecutor related to Conrad Roy. No, it's just the beginning. It's just so much stuff. It's some of the best writing I've ever done. It's some of the hardest work I've ever done. It relates to the giant cover-up of the role of psychiatric drugs, which got very poorly covered despite my report to the court, which you can read, and despite the scientific articles, which are there for you to read, despite my testimony. You'll see how they just managed to just not even consider that. So my blog, may it help turn things around. You can get it right off of Bregan.com. You can get it from Madness in America, and it's accompanied by the Michelle Carter Archives, which gives you a ton of information, much of it that the DA doesn't want you to know, and much of it that the press doesn't want you to know. So I don't ask for this. I think this is the only thing I've asked this about, and that is, you know, honor me by just checking out that blog, because I want that blog to be read around the world. And of course, it's not something I get paid for. I want it to be read around the world. So my guest today, Brant Mittler, he is an amazing man. He was and is, I guess, I will tell us, a cardiologist. Went into practice back in 1976. Then he went to law school. He's down in San Antonio, and he's in the practice of the law. We have in common undergraduate work at Harvard, took his medical and cardiology training at Duke, where our paths indirectly crossed. I ended up being the expert witness against a man he worked for. Maybe we'll get to talk about that. A psychiatrist who was sending, I'll give you a hint, who was abusing his patients and sending them for lobotomies back at Harvard. There's so much we could just talk about. He's a few years ago, he had a big $7.5 million verdict that's of great importance. He calls himself the disruptive doctor. And the last time we talked, we ranged over eugenics, euthanasia, the post-truth world. Boy, are we ever in the post-truth world. And the importance of doctors and patients making shared decisions. And, of course, I think he probably agrees with me in the ultimate long run, they're not shared, they're the patient's decisions. And we've crossed in different ways. And I just want to welcome Brant to the show. I want to keep in touch with you, Brant, and maybe after the show or over the weekend we can talk some more about legal cases, because you just got me stimulated on things I want to suggest to you, and I'm sure you got things to suggest to me. So hi, and welcome back.
Hi, Peter. Thank you for having me. It's really an honor to be on your show. And let me just say at the outset that I've read these your blogs on the Michelle Carter case, and I need to study them more, but it is a remarkable a group of writings that you've done. And, you know, we live in this time of the popular phrase is fake news. And as an attorney, I still practice medicine part-time, but mostly I'm an attorney, litigator. We think in terms of negligence. And the concept of negligence includes acts and omissions, right? Things that people do and things that they fail to do. Now, with respect to the media, and I'm just the average media consumer who followed the Michelle Carter case long distance and saw what the mainstream media put on the air and wrote, I had no idea what the case was really about. And so that's why your blogs are remarkable. And really, the media are guilty of fake news because of what they fail to report. And that's why I think all of your listeners, and I hope a lot of other people, will read your blogs. And frankly, I hope you'll turn them into a book, because you really need to document to the world what the mainstream media have not documented about this case, which is very important. And I congratulate you for your courage and your scholarship in this case.
It did take some courage, because after my second blog, the trial's over. Now I'm just a private citizen blogging. After my second blog, the assistant DA went to the judge, the trial judge, trial's over, and asked the trial judge to stop my blogging. Now, that's an extraordinary measure, usually reserved for the federal government going to a court on an emergency basis and asking them to stop the publication in some newspaper of something that's going to endanger the safety of all of America. And even then, they usually don't get what they want. Prior censorship stopped me from writing any further until the court allowed me to go on, if they ever would. Later, I found out that not long after this district attorney, Rayburn, assistant district attorney, tried to stop me, I found out the reason. She was waiting to get appointed by the governor as a judge, which then happened about 10 or 11 days after she tried to stop the publication of my blogs, during which I did take a holiday to let the judge make up his mind without my interfering. Just, you know, judge, yeah, what are you going to say? Now, the judge came through. No prior censorship, not even any criticism of me. Just reminded all of us that about his rules, which were that we couldn't talk about anything I knew from the medical records of the victim of the suicide, Conrad Roy. But I hadn't been doing about that. Never planned to do that. So you can see some of the private motives going on, but there were political motives as well. Now, interestingly enough, the New York Times did talk about the freedom of speech issues involved in saying that Michelle Conrad could kill somebody with words by allegedly telling him to get back in his lethal truck. But nobody, I don't know anybody, and there were press there that covered the attack on me by Rayburn, which was done on an emergency basis, so I wasn't even there. So she got all this, she timed all this negative attack on me, telling untruths about what I was doing, to be covered by the press. And then the judge exonerated, and I wrote about it, basically exonerated by not criticizing me at all or trying to stop me. And the press didn't raise a single eyebrow about her calling for, Ms. Rayburn, calling for stopping my publications. The press doesn't even put freedom of press first. It puts its self-interest first, which is defense of the pharmaceutical industry. And to talk about my freedom of speech now would be to talk about my criticism of the pharmaceutical industry. Now, back in the 80s, when they went after me and my freedom of speech, the New York Times and a lot of other press took that story and defended my freedom of speech. And I won that particular episode again. But now, the media is so in the pocket of the pharmaceutical industry and all the advertising they give them, they didn't peep about somebody attacking my freedom of speech, because that's exactly what the drug companies want. So disappointing the direction America's increasingly going in. And now I'm going to sit back and, Brand, I'm going to unleash you.
No, thank Peter, you I agree. I agree with everything you said. We think very much alike. You know, I've had a lot of dealings with the media over the years. It was back in 1985 and 1986 that I was involved with a group called Physicians Who Care, and we tried to educate the public and the media about the harmful effects of managed care and HMOs, which really came to light a great deal in the late 1990s. And then the media shied away from any of those stories because these are big advertisers. You know, the big insurance companies are some of the most powerful corporate entities in the world. And what I've seen over the years, especially now with the advent of social media, is that the print media are really running scared. I mean, you just don't see the print media taking on, you know, they're not going to take up the cause of Peter Bregan, who criticizes the pharmaceutical industry. They know who the big advertisers are. They know where the big money is. And, you know, they're afraid of going out of business. You know the old saw, the famous great newspaper man, A.J. Liebling, who said that freedom of the press means freedom for the owners of the press. And the person who told me that was the late Harry Schwartz, who wrote for the New York Times editorial page for 29 years and was very much a critic of newspapers and other media for not taking up the cause of doctors in practice and, you know, for supporting managed care and HMOs. So I think you've correctly identified a trend, and that's that the media are not great defenders of freedom of speech anymore, except if it affects them. The other thing I think that your listeners should know is that, you know, you suffered attacks on your credibility and professional behavior during this trial, but it goes on. Today, I looked at a daily news feed from a medical news aggregator, and there was a link to an article in a magazine called Psychiatric Times. And here was a article by two prominent people, one of whom is a professor of law at a prominent East Coast university, attacking you for your testimony and your analysis in the Michelle Carter trial. So, you know, I'm sure it's going to go on. You're going to be attacked for your courage in doing a really detailed, comprehensive analysis of all of the literally, I believe there were thousands of texts and communications between these two troubled youth in both with complex psychiatric histories and complex family situations that were just boiled down to a very simplistic message for the public in what you describe as a vendetta in a witch hunt that she texted him into committing suicide. It's really a very sad commentary on the current mainstream media.
I'll tell you a funny story about that Psychiatric Times article you found. Do you have the headline in front of you there anywhere? I can't remember it, but it was a funny headline. It was.
I do.
Yeah,
because
I'm headline read says, that headline, because I'm going to tell you a funny story about it.
Warning: antidepressants may cause messaging manslaughter.
Yeah. Okay, so when I heard about it, I went to look it up, and I thought I found it, but I found one from years earlier. Warning, and in the same newspaper, Psychiatric Times, which of course is big money comes pouring in many directions from the pharmaceutical industry. But it said the same thing. It said, warning, psychiatric drugs may cause you to rob a bank. And I thought, right. Wait a minute, what that's about? I don't remember that. So I looked that one up, and it's about a case years earlier that I had, in which the judge agreed that that a man had gone into a manic state and gone out. He'd robbed his wife's bank, robbed his mother's bank. He robbed his own pharmacy wearing sunglasses. He thought he was some great figure out of the movies. He was high on street drugs. He was high on Xanax and antidepressants, as I recall. But they didn't mention me there. It's just my story, but in those days, they were desperately trying never to mention me. So the fact that they actually attacked me personally in this new one means I'm doing something really good out there. I mean,
exactly. Obviously,
I'm having some effect.
Well, even this study cites to, in spite of their trying to, be very negative about your analysis and testimony, they cite to a Swedish study which showed a relationship between SSRIs and violent crime convictions for individuals aged 15 to 24. Exactly the people with the unformed brain, so to speak, and other behavioral aspects that you've talked about. And then they go on to try to discredit that study. So, obviously there's a lot of evidence out there which you've documented over the years, along with your own analysis, that, that's being attacked. That's why I think people need to read your blogs and they need to study what you say.
Well, thank you much for that. And
but let me talk about one other thing. And it was interesting this week when we were talking about the Michelle Carter case. I told you I was writing I'm working on a book. I'm working on two books. One is a medical memoir of sort of my experiences in college and medical school and residency training, and then throughout my 4 years in practice, it led me to this being like you, a really critic of mainstream medicine, in the sense that my criticism stems from the fact that nobody looks at actual outcomes of care, that they apply all sorts of procedures and surgeries and all sorts of medications, and nobody looks at what actually happens to the patient. But in working on this memoir, I was recalling some significant events during my medical school years at Duke, and I was at Duke Medical School from 1968 to 1972. Now, let me just say that I'm not negative about Duke. I'm relating some encounters and some experiences, but I still have an adjunct faculty appointment at Duke in the Department of Medicine, which I've had since 1992. But I hope, as a critical thinker, people will understand that I still have criticisms of the university. So when I was a second-year medical student at Duke, and Duke had a radical new curriculum, and what was the radical new curriculum? You got to see patients in your second year of medical school. And so you had a series of six-week rotations. Well, one six-week rotation was in psychiatry. And I was assigned to a very prominent staff psychiatrist named Bernard Bressler. And what I'm going to say has been there's nothing confidential here, because this is the subject of lawsuits and newspaper articles. But Bressler was, unbeknownst to me as a second-year medical student, he turned out he was a pretty controversial guy, because he was medicating mainly women patients who had anxiety and depression with a whole series of drugs, and I'll let you explain it. But when I was on his service, there were these women walking around in negligees and house coats, and they seemed like in a zombie state. And there was no real teaching of psychiatry. He was using me as a medical student to take to do to-do lists for the various patients. Do this for this at home. They need this grocery or that. And many of these women were hospitalized for months, or actually weeks, and some actually months. Well, in any case, I later found out that residents in training were filing complaints against him. Later in the 1980s, there were medical malpractice lawsuits against him for this reckless prescribing, and actually allegations that he had sex with patients. And he ultimately left Duke. Well, I found out about this later because my first wife was the daughter of the chairman of the zoology department at Duke, and her mother, my ex-mother-in-law, sent me clippings of what happened to Bressler, because she had heard me complain about that the rather bizarre experience I had in my first psychiatric course in medical school. So I'll leave it at that. I then, in reading about the clippings that this week that my mother-in-law had sent me in the 1980s, I suddenly came across your name as an expert witness, and I'll, yes. I'll let you continue.
Oh, my God. I mean, folks, you know, as it said, you can't make this stuff up. When you read my blogs, oh, my God, I hope you will, and send it to your friends on Justify all the work I've been doing on it. My wife thinks I just resurfaced from some other place. You know, you can't make this stuff up, and you certainly can't make up Bernie Bressler. I got called into, I think it was three cases, and one of them was just, I think, readily settled. I can't remember exactly. But two were quite momentous. Bernie got involved with patients, and he went into business, and they lost money with him, two of them. And he had sex with at least one of them. I can't remember whether it was two. And then when they complained, he sent them for lobotomies at Harvard Medical School with Ballantyne, somebody I put out of business with multiple lawsuits, working with some lawyers, obviously. And Ballantyne had free reign. Nobody supervised him at Harvard, and he was just a surgeon operating on his own. He was doing cingulotomies. That's cutting some of the connections that go right in from the cingulum into the frontal lobes, and doing essentially lobotomies, was doing lobotomies. And in Bressler's case, the statute of limitations had run, and the attorneys felt there was just about no way to reverse the statute of limitations. That's usually true. You just can't reverse it. And I said, well, look, at least give me a chance to write to these two judges a scientific analysis of the injustice involved in a man sleeping with patients, taking money from patients, using them, and then when they complain, lobotomizing them, sending them for a lobotomy so they can never have the wherewithal to bring a suit, so that they're not competent anymore to bring a suit until years later family members bring a suit on behalf of the helpless human being who's been so damaged by the lobotomy, the cingulotomy. And it was a unique approach, you know. Can you let somebody get away with so damaging the patient after the malpractice and perpetrating more malpractice that they then don't have the wherewithal in their minds and brains to bring a suit? Well, the first judge said flat out, he agrees. He's going to let this go to trial. He's not going to impose the statute of limitations. Go to trial. And they immediately settled for Bernie's insurance coverage, I believe it was, I don't know, $1 million or something. And the second judge looked at it and said, yeah, this makes a lot of sense to me. I'm going to let the jury decide when we go to trial on whether they should let the statute toll. These are unusual decisions. And again, the last thing they wanted to insurance or Bernie or Duke wanted was to go to trial. So they, too, settled for the maximum. So these were big moments in my life, and so upsetting. I mean, just I never had any cause to celebrate. It was like, what horror stories! And I never did adequately write about the Bressler trials, like I've now written about what happened to Michelle Carter, and also to Conrad Roy. What was done to him by psychiatry and his own family and society. So I never did write in depth. I think I just mentioned him in a few paragraphs somewhere about I couldn't wrap my mind around and do it back then. I've seen so much harm, folks.
And you know, there are some parallels in the sense. Here's one parallel. It really it speaks to the issue of almost absolute power. You talked about the prosecutors. We know that prosecutors have a huge amount of power. And in your last blog, you rightfully talk about one of the most important traits of a prosecutor and a duty of a prosecutor is to exercise discretion. And you argue that the prosecutor in the Michelle Carter case did not exercise the appropriate discretion, and then combined it with a vendetta, and then combined it with political ambition, which is very common among, all too often among prosecutors. But when you look at the medical school setting, now look at Duke, and it's not really a criticism just of Duke, but one of the things I'm writing about in my memoir is the almost unbridled power of in the academic medical center. It's a command and control situation, just like the military, where the chief of the department and the professors get to, you know, dictate the right way to practice medicine, in spite of the fact they may not know the right way to practice medicine, or may be practicing in a totally negligent way. I mean, in Bressler's case, the combinations of drugs he was prescribing were mind-blowing. It was amazing that, and I can remember women on the psych ward walking around like zombies. And, you know, it was because of these of this combination. But nobody was really questioning him because he was a very powerful professor who, at least for many years, was generating a lot of money for an academic medical center. Now, I think the other tragedy of that case that came out in newspaper reporting in the 1980s was that the then president of Duke, Dr. Brody, was a psychiatrist and, in fact, had been chairman of the psychiatry department. So, you know, he was involved in this institutional cover-up, so to speak. It took a long time for the victims of Bressler to get justice. And it speaks to something else that I've seen in my medical practice and certainly more recently in the 16 years that I've been a litigating attorney, is that if you have to rely just on hospitals' peer review systems and doctors monitoring themselves, you'll be sorely disappointed. It was interesting to see the Duke authorities calling the lawsuits against Bressler frivolous. When I file lawsuits, and I think I've never filed a frivolous lawsuit, that the first defense is always, this is a frivolous lawsuit. So anyway, in my mind, the Bressler cases do have some parallels to the Michelle Carter case in terms of the dangers and the harmful effects of absolute power.
And that's such a problem in psychiatry, where we're given by law the opportunity for absolute power to treat people against their will and to break them in the process by drugging them so they can't even make a decent appearance in front of the judge, and then drugging them so that they stop complaining after we get the judge to give us even more power over them. I'm so glad you brought up Brody. I was thinking about that. I didn't look up anything about Bressler so off the top of my head because I've been working so hard on Michelle Carter until I finally pressed the button at 7 p.m. last night on the last and sent off the last blog six, you know, the final blog in the series, most likely the final one anyway. Now, this may have happened after your time, but I believe that by the time I got involved as the expert, really the single psychiatric expert in this group of cases against him, Duke had moved him off the wards, and he had a ward in a hotel nearby the hospital. Was he on the ward within the medical hospital wards when you met him?
Yes, he was. When I met him, it was during the year 1969.
Oh, it's long ago. God, he got away with this for so long.
Well, when I looked up his medical license, I don't think he lost his medical license in North Carolina. He voluntarily gave it up, I think, in 1988. He moved to Virginia in 1979, yes. And then I think, according to the records I looked at, he didn't lose his Virginia license until medical license until 2004. And again, it shows you how slow the medical authorities can be in
dealing with, for all we know, he's licensed somewhere else right now.
Well, I don't even know if he's still alive. And so I really can't. I haven't done that kind of a search. But the other thing, you know, when you talk about this, we talked about asymmetric power and mental health. You brought up a really great point about the power to use the full force of the government to lock up those with mental illness and medicate them against their will. But we also see in our society the terrible problem of the incarceration of the mentally ill, right? The failure of our society to deal with them. And so we use jails as a place to house the mentally ill. And that's another example of the coercive power of government to deal with those with mental illness in a totally irrational way. And we know it's been used against the African-American population, people of color. And that's why we have the highest incarceration rate in the world.
Yeah, the dismantling of the state mental hospitals, which were used as the place where you sent everybody you didn't want and housed them cheaply, with their demise, which was totally not to do with helping them. It was a financial shift from the states to when the patients got on to federal disability, then they could be housed outside the state system in the nursing homes and other places like that. The emptying of the hospitals was not something done for the patients, and it wasn't due to the advent of the antipsychotic drugs, because they came in 1954, and nowhere in the world did the emptying begin in the 1960s. So it had nothing to do with that. I'm agreeing with you.
Well, we're talking about a lot of different topics here, but the other aspect about forced the use of psychiatry for political purposes or psychiatric diagnoses is the use of the former Soviet Union, you know, banning political dissidents or putting them in psychiatric hospitals and treating them in harsh fashion with drugs and all sorts of other treatments for their political views. Now, let me just say the reason we may have discussed this. I haven't listened to their prior show and I can't recall, but
don't worry,
it's
a long time ago.
Yeah, one of the reasons I call my blog, which, by the way, I stopped blogging in 2014 because as an expert witness, I was being accosted by assistant U.S. attorneys in a couple of federal cases. I was testifying on behalf of families of deceased people who had gotten care in federal institutions, and they were quizzing me at length over what I was writing in my blog. So I sort of stopped blogging back then. I should resume it, but one of the reasons I called the blog The Disruptive Doctor is because right now, because as an attorney, I also defend doctors who are labeled with the term disruptive. Very often doctors who oppose hospital administrators or advocate on behalf of their patients will be labeled disruptive. They can do that under the so-called peer review laws. And commonly they're sent for psychiatric evaluation as part of the peer review process. It's just mind-boggling. I hope the listeners understand that for the most part, the peer review process for which hospitals and HMOs and other medical entities have qualified immunity. In other words, they're immune from being sued and having to respond to normal discovery requests in the legal system. They do that because they supposedly are doing peer review to enhance patient quality. But in fact, hospitals and large hospital corporations and HMOs are using the peer review process to silence doctors who question quality and who are dissenters. So they turn the peer review process on its head. They don't go after the people they should be going after, and they go after doctors who try to defend patients, and they call them disruptive. And I end up defending some of those doctors. It's not a large part of my practice, but I've had some fairly prominent cases over the years. So that's where the term disruptive comes from. I defended a doctor recently successfully that protested when a hospital was sending a patient having an acute stroke, a stroke in process, out of the hospital to a rehabilitation facility. They said the doctor raised his voice. They called him disruptive. They said he was a threat to quality for protesting the inappropriate transfer of a patient, who, by the way, was transferred inappropriately and died 2 days later, having an acute stroke. They made the doctor go for a psychiatric evaluation. It's incredible what goes on, and none of this ever is or can be aired publicly. These are all secret proceedings protected by the peer review process. Just incredible. And it's another use, inappropriate use of psychiatry and psychiatrists who will do the bidding of the hospitals, in my view, persecuting these kinds of physicians who stand up for their patients.
Such a difficult, knotty problem, how to monitor. I mean, the peer-reviewed system in journals does exactly the same. What the peer-reviewed folks, if you don't know this, the peer-reviewed system is where to get something published in a journal, you have to get it reviewed by your peers. Now, what does that mean? It means that you can't get anything published that threatens your peers, which means you can't get good science published because good science is likely to threaten old science.
Exactly.
You can't get anything ethical published because that's likely to threaten the kinds of people who do peer review or who are usually authoritarian people who aren't necessarily very ethical. So,
well, and also we know it's well known, and I've published papers, and when I was at Duke, I actually one of my mentors was the editor of Circulation, and he was a very free thinker, Dr. Eugene Stead, one of the great people in American medicine. He actually, as a cardiology fellow, he let me review major papers, which was amazing. But the usual editorial process in these journals is the editors know the biases of the reviewers. And so if they want an article to be published, they'll send it to a reviewer who thinks along the lines that the article is supporting. And if they want it to be rejected, they'll send it to a whole host of people they know are anti the view of the authors. It's a highly politicized process, and I've written about this in the past. The process of journal peer review is highly political. And again, it's very much bound up with advancement in academic medicine. One doesn't advance from instructor to assistant professor to associate professor to full professor without a lot of publications. And in order to get those articles published in the right prestigious journals, you've got to bend your writing. You've got to say what you know that the top people in the field want you to say. It's tough to become a professor in a major medical school in the United States without being engaging in groupthink. There are not many free thinkers who reach that point unless perhaps they stumbled onto a discovery that awarded them the Nobel Prize. Otherwise, there's an enormous amount of groupthink in academic medicine, and that's one of the things that suppresses innovation in medicine, is the groupthink among the so-called leaders of American medicine.
I'm so glad you're talking about all this. This has not been really dealt with adequately on the show in all the years here. I think this is really very important, these last few minutes. We're talking, folks, if you just tuned in, with Brant Mittler, Mittler, from Houston, Texas, cardiologist and lawyer. Shares with me Harvard College, and he went to Duke for medical training and has gone to law school, and he's doing a lot of good things. Yeah, and of course, another thing, if you're going to get to be full professor, is you can't be a disruptive doctor. You can't disrupt anything along the way. You can't act threatening to the powers that be in any way along the way.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the people who become Dr. Stead wrote an interesting essay in his later years, and he was chairman of medicine at Duke and one of the really famous people in American medicine. You can read a really too short obituary about him in the New York Times and several years ago. But he wrote a really interesting essay on medical education when he was editor in his later years of the North Carolina Medical Journal. And he said that what kind of students does the medical faculty want? He said the medical faculty wants students who won't cause them any trouble. And he said that's why they want people who make A's in organic chemistry. He says because they know that someone who makes an A in organic chemistry is not a troublemaker. They follow orders. He said, I'd rather have a medical school of people who made C's in organic chemistry. He says, they're liable to be free thinkers and not do things the traditional way. It was a bit tongue-in-cheek, but I think it has a lot of truth to it. And he's the one who really, in his later years, supported the concept and taught me. And I guess he liked me because I made a C in organic chemistry at Harvard. And still got into Duke, but he taught me in a small group around him that the professors really didn't know the outcomes when they treated patients with chronic disease, and that's why he founded the Duke computerized cardiology data bank. When we started that data bank, in the late 60s, and I worked on as a medical student in the early 70s as a cardiology fellow at Duke, the IBM computer took up a huge room. It was a massive computer. But the idea was to look at patients with coronary artery disease and see what really happened to them over time. And the decision was, should they be treated with medicine or treated with bypass surgery? That was the decision then. Now we have much more complex decisions with angioplasty and stents and what kind of stent, drug-eluting stents, and, you know, various kinds of other devices, and a lot of other medicines. But the simple decision then was medicine versus surgery. And he set up a special division to call patients every 6 months and find out whether they were alive, what their symptom status was, and other things about their condition, and put all of this information into the computer system. So that every time a doctor sat down with a patient and made a decision, he or she could look at all the patients like that patient who had been treated at Duke and see how they did over time. And that was a very radical idea. It threatened the professors. It caused a lot of disruption. And ultimately, that system didn't survive. Even though I'm amused when I look at all of the money being spent on the electronic medical record now. We computerized the entire medical record in cardiology at Duke in the early 1970s. And it generated all of the procedure reports, and we could also see outcomes over time. Everything that they're now spending billions to do was done and rejected by the insurance industry and by the leaders of academic medicine back in the 70s.
Wow.
But the radical idea is outcomes, and the idea of outcomes applies to cardiology, to psychiatry. It's what you talk about, Peter. When you treat people with various drugs, what happens to them? We need to look at actual outcomes in actual patients, and that's what's not being done in medicine. Instead, we have academicians who put on long white coats, right, and strut around the hospitals and say, I've got a long white coat, I'm a professor, I'm the named professor, and therefore what I say is true, irrespective of whether it actually correlates with actual outcomes in actual patients.
Have you ever looked at diet in cardiology? You know, there's a famous old film out, Forks Over Knives, in which there's a cardiologist who talks about saving people from all surgeries by putting them on, you know, a low-fat and zero, milk products, dairy products, and carbohydrate diets. Have you looked into that at all?
Well, you know, Peter, there's that is a ongoing long-term controversy in medicine and cardiology. And the most famous proponent of the ultra-low-fat, basically vegetarian diet is Dr. Dean Ornish. And Ornish has published studies over the years showing what he claims to be regression of atherosclerotic blockages in the arteries and treatment of coronary disease with his kind of diet, which was somewhat similar, as you recall, to the Pritikin diet. And remember, Dr. Pritikin advocated an ultra-low animal fat diet and high in vegetables diet. The controversy has included, more recently, the Atkins diet and a more of a high animal fat diet with claims that even that kind of a diet will not cause atherosclerosis. So it's a raging controversy. I don't claim to be an expert on it. You recall when Dr. Atkins died, and he died tragically when he slipped and fell, and I believe it was in New York, and suffered a skull fracture. His autopsy showed he did have some coronary artery disease. Yeah. He did have blockages in a couple of his arteries, but he didn't die of a heart attack. So is diet
important?
Well,
this is way away from Atkins. I think Atkins was not a vegetable-based diet, low-fat,
no,
was it?
Atkins was a heavy animal fat diet. That's the point.
Yeah.
And there are many people who now advocate a high protein diet. But I think the controversy continues. I don't claim to be an expert. I'm an advocate of a moderate diet, even though I tend to have more protein in the form of vegetable protein in my diet. And I'm fortunate that I know my coronaries are normal. So I try to tell my patients to at least adopt a moderate diet. But unfortunately, most of them are subjected to the fast food diet, as you know, which is a very, very harmful diet.
Yeah. I've been working with a nutritionist named Pam Popper. We're doing some educational programs together around psychiatry, not around nutrition. I've gone on a low-fat diet that is has absolutely none of the stuff I used to love, like cheese and various products made from various dairy products, and low oil, not even the so-called good oils. And she looks at the science and also at evolution, and so I'm basically eating potatoes and rice, and I like well-cooked vegetables. And what happened in the first couple of months, I lost 25 pounds, and I've kept that off. I'm up to 28. I've gotten rid of my blood pressure medicine entirely, and I've dropped another medicine. And even joints that used to ache don't ache anymore. So I've become a real believer. And my wife, who had very serious inflammatory kinds of illnesses that have really kept her from having a full life, is on the same diet that's Pam Popper's advocated now. And she's pain-free for the first time in a couple of decades in terms of joint pains and also her gut. So,
well, that's really important, and I'm really glad to hear that. You bring up several important points medically. Number one, fat tissue, particularly abdominal fat, is associated with so many so many inflammatory agents. You get rid of the fat tissue, and you markedly reduce inflammation in your body, and so you all have experienced the benefits of that. Number two,
that's one of the first big points that Pam makes, and she says that includes olive oil. None of the oils, they all cause fat, and they all have problems associated with it, and they're inflammatory problems from her viewpoint. But go ahead.
And the second thing about fat tissue is it has millions of miles of blood vessels, right? It's highly vascular. So your heart has to pump. Remember, the heart's just like any other muscle. Just think if you do biceps curls, you get your bicep strong. If your heart is having to pump against high resistance and millions of miles of blood vessels, then it's going to get thick, the heart muscle, and you'll get left ventricular hypertrophy or an enlarged heart. So that's another reason to get rid of the fat. So, and we know that weight loss is a great way to lower blood pressure. But, you know, I've now been practicing cardiology for, what, 40? I've started my 41st year in private practice, and you just wear yourself out telling people if you just lose 10 or 15 pounds, I promise your blood pressure will come down. You might be able to stop one of those three medicines you're taking. It's so hard to get people to lose weight, but we keep trying. So congratulations.
Yeah, and I've started to talk to some of my patients. Many of the people who come see me have chronic illnesses, and it isn't a magic for your brain. It's not this BS about we'll change your neurotransmitters, but it's simply true. If you feel physically better, you're going to feel mentally better. And so I'm starting to really now combine good, solid diet without any gimmicks, nothing to sell you. It's just for your benefit. It's very inexpensive way to eat. And I think it's going to be a very important part of what I'm recommending to people. And I've only been doing it for a month or two for my clients, my patients, and they're responding. Some of them are responding. It's a guarantee for weight loss. Go ahead.
That's great. Let me just put in one more pitch for wellness, which I think is important as I've aged, and I'm now 70 years old. I think the importance of exercise, both the American Heart Association and other entities recommend both aerobic exercise like walking or running and also weight training, resistance. Some wise observer said one of the main reasons people end up in nursing homes, either their brain stops working or their muscles stop working or both. And as we get older, we tend to get sarcopenic. In other words, we lose muscle mass. Resistance training is very important. And I'm not talking about going out and lifting massive weights, but I think everybody needs to do some resistance training to keep the muscle strong. So I would just put in a pitch for both some weight training and aerobic training if people are physically able to do it.
I think that's the next step for me. I get so busy. My main exercise is walking my dogs a few times a day. It's good. It helps. But that's the next step for me, is to cut out time from all the millions of things I'm doing. And that's the hard part for all of us, and say, okay, going to get that weight training, do some resistance work and do some more real cardiovascular exercise.
That's great advice.
My God, we just ran through it. Brant Mittler, they're telling me to get off the air here. The music is starting. Brant Mittler, wonderful, from San Antonio, cardiologist, lawyer. Just thank you so much for a very interesting show. I lost track of time.
Thank you, Peter.
So interesting. Thank you so much. Bye-bye now.
Bye.